La Prabhupada ki jai. ISKCON founder Acharya, Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Anantakoti, Vaishnava Vrinda ki jai. Namacharya, Srila Haridas Thakur ki jai. Param se kaho Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Dvaita Gadadha. Shivasadi Gaur Bhakta Vrinda ki jai. Shri Shri Radha Krishna Gopi Gopata Sayam Kun Radha Kunda. Giri Govardhan ki jai, Vrindavanam ki jai, Mathuranam ki jai, Navadeepdam ki jai, Jagratasami ki jai, Yamunamaye ki jai, Srimati Lassi Devi ki jai, Samaveda Bhakta Vrinda ki jai, Gaur Premananda Hari Hari Bo. All glories the assembled devotees, all glories the assembled devotees, all glories the assembled devotees. All glories to Shri Guru and Gauranga, Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Gaur Premananda. So, Om Gana, Timiranda Shah, Gananjana, Shilakaya Chakshuram, Meditam, Yena, Tasmai, Shri Gurave Namaha. So, I offer my respectful obeisances unto the lotus feet of my spiritual master, His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami, Srila Prabhupada, who has so kindly opened my eyes with the torchlight of knowledge while I was blinded in the darkness of ignorance. So first we're going to talk about the Acharyas who teach the knowledge in Bhagavad Gita. And we're going to start with Shankaracharya. And I'm sure many of you have heard of Shankaracharya. Let's go back a little before Shankaracharya. Before the turn of the first millennium, we had Lord Buddha appear. And Lord Buddha appeared for the specific purpose, and he's an incarnation of Krishna, specific purpose of taking people away from the Vedas. Now that's quite shocking. Okay, if we can just pack and not talk, I would appreciate it. No. So Lord Buddha came, who is an incarnation of Krishna, came with a specific purpose of taking people away from the Vedas. Now, why would Krishna want to take people away from the Vedas? As we described last week, the Vedas are emanating directly from Krishna, and they teach the absolute truth, both phenomenal and numinous knowledge, knowledge about the spiritual world, knowledge about this material world. Well, the reason is people were misusing the Vedas for two purposes. One, to make money with, which also happened in Judaism too. That's why Lord Jesus Christ appeared, to actually stop the money changers and to bring the temple back to, you know, originally what it was supposed to be instead of a place for killing animals. Same thing happened in India. The Brahmins were using the Vedas to make money because they had a monopoly, number one. And number two, they were engaged in a lot of animal killing in the name of Vedic sacrifices. So there was an extreme measure necessary. So Lord Buddha came and said, forget about these Vedas. Ahimsa, Paramo Dharma. That means non-violence is the supreme Dharma. And everyone said, Jai Hari Bol. They didn't say Hari Bol, but they said Jai. And so under the Emperor Ashoka, basically all of India became Buddhist. And they became much more peaceful at that time and stopped killing animals to a large extent. Then it was necessary to bring people back to the right Vedic understanding, but it wasn't possible to bring them back in one stroke because they were attached to Buddhism. They were attached basically to the principles of Buddhism, which most of them are very, very nice. In fact, they're all very nice, they just don't go far enough. Lord Buddha never taught against God. He taught more or less a psychological way to become free from the material miseries. You know, the Four Noble Truths, material world is suffering, attachment causes the suffering, give up the attachment, give up the suffering, and number four, the Eightfold Path is the way to do that. So it was necessary to bring them part of the way back to the Vedas. So therefore, you had Shankaracharya, who appeared in about the year 783, who is considered to be an incarnation of Lord Shiva. And he taught covered Buddhism, Buddhism in the name slightly different. It was like impersonalism. You know, The Buddhism that was being taught to a large extent was what we call voidism. In other words, everything is nothing. What's the sound? You know, Zen Buddhism, what's the sound of one hand clapping? Stuff like that. And nothing has meaning, or certain aspects of Buddhism are similar to atomism. Everything is atoms or like that. And nowadays, Buddhism is very popular, especially amongst those who study quantum mechanics. And I'm not going to get into why. So he brought them back part of the way by teaching an impersonalistic or atheistic philosophy. But actually, Shankaracharya was a devotee. In the Padma Purana, and I'm going to read a very interesting quote, Lord Shiva speaks. He says, Mayavada shat shastram prachana bodhamuchate mayaheva gotidham devi kalo brahmana murtina. He says, in the age of Kali, I shall preach the Mayavada philosophy, which is nothing but covered Buddhism in the garb of a Brahmin. So that's Shankaracharya. But actually, he revealed his real intentions as he was getting ready to leave this world when he chastised his disciples for being Mayavadis. You know, his whole life he's teaching his Mayavada. So when getting ready to leave this world is his famous quote, which I'm sure many of you know, but I'll read the whole thing. Vaja Govinda, Vaja Govinda, Vaja Govinda Mudhamate, Mudhamate. That means you are asses. That's a very harsh criticism to give your disciples. I haven't tried that one yet. And then he says, here's the rest of the Sanskrit verse. Samprate sanite kale nahi nahi rakshati durin karane. You intellectual fools. Just worship Govinda, just worship Govinda, just worship Govinda. Three times. Your grammatical knowledge and word jugglery will not save you at the time of death. And of course, Shankaracharya did write a Gita Bhashya, you know, a commentary on the Gita that establishes Krishna as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And that's what the Gita does. Srila Prabhupada, our spiritual master, specifically entitled his Bhagavad Gita, Bhagavad Gita as it is, because he did not give any indirect interpretation of the words of Krishna. Practically speaking, every other Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says something, but then someone uses the words of Krishna to put forth his own philosophy. In other words, that's intellectual dishonesty. Like if you say something to me, the sky is blue, let's say you say. Right now it's gray, but let's say you say the sky is blue. And I say, well, you don't really mean blue. You mean red. And so, So when Krishna says something, he really means it, and it's true. So if someone says, well, Krishna doesn't really mean what he says or says what he means, that's pretty crazy. I mean, why would Krishna lie except when he's stealing butter? But the Bhagavad Gita does not deal with Makanchor, with Krishna stealing butter. The Bhagavad Gita deals with Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. It's different. Krishna gets in different moods at different times. When he's stealing butter, don't believe him. When he's fighting on the opposite side in the battle of Kurukshetra, don't believe him. But when he speaks the Bhagavad Gita, then you can really trust him at that particular point, because he's instructing Arjuna in spiritual knowledge. So, after Shankaracharya presented his philosophy, and he actually was a great devotee, it's Lord Shiva, Vaishnavanam, Yathashambhu. Then we had several other acharyas who taught Krishna consciousness from different angles of vision. First of all, there was Sripad Vishnu Swami. Everyone's heard of Vishnu Swami? He taught something called Shuddha Dvaita, purified monism. In other words, he actually came before Shankaracharya. And he's in the 3rd century B.C., which is interesting. And his most prominent acharya in the modern day is Sridhar Swami, who Srila Prabhupada utilized in his Bhaktivedanta purports. And he consulted Sridhar Swami's purports. And Prabhupada and Lord Chaitanya considered Sridhar Swami to be basically the authority par excellence in in the Bhagavad Gita and the Srimad Bhagavatam. And that's mentioned in the Chaitanya Charitamrita. And Lord Chaitanya considered anyone who deviated from Sridhara Swami's commentaries to be like a prostitute. And he used the wordplay of Swami sometimes meaning husband or master, because it means master. But generally in the Vedic context, the wife will call the husband master. We don't do that now. So that was Sridhara Swami, or Vishnu Swami, who preached Sridhara Swami's philosophy. And then after that, there was Ramanujacharya, who's the most famous, I think, of all the Acharyas. And he was a member of the Lakshmi or Sri Sampradaya. And most of the temples in Andhra Pradesh and Tamil Nadu are actually followers of Ramanujacharya. In fact, his samadhi is in Sri Rangam. Anyone here been to Sri Rangam? Yeah, some of you have been to Sri Rangam. They actually have his physical form preserved there, and he's holding up the danda. So he's a very important personality. It's a Vishishta Dvaita philosophy, you know, purified oneness. And basically, his presentation is practically the same as our Achincha Beda Beda Tattva philosophy that we talk about following Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So he's a very important acharya, and he spread Krishna consciousness everywhere and defeated many impersonalists, Mayavadis, and people who are atheistic. And then after that, you have Nimbarka Acharya. I mean, there's some, let us say, controversy whether he appeared thousands of years ago or whether he appeared in the 11th or 12th centuries. But anyway, so he's called Nimbarka Acharya because he caused the sun to shine when the sun wasn't shining. Very interesting. And he is the author of what's called the Dvaita philosophy, duality and non-duality at the same time. I'm not going to get into that. I mean, there's a whole class I can give about that. And he's considered to be an incarnation of the Sudarsana Chakra. So these personalities that we're mentioning are not just ordinary acharyas or ordinary devotees. They're actually special devotees that have come down from the spiritual world. And then finally, you have Madhvacharya, Shripad Madhvacharya, whose headquarters is in Udupi, and we're, of course, members of Madhvacharya's Sampradaya. And Madhvacharya is called Purnapragya, and that's the name of his Bhashya, or his commentary, the Purnapragya Bhashya, and he taught Shuddha Dvaita, which is pure dualism. So you actually have these four acharyas. And there was something else about Madhvacharya. Oh yeah, Madhvacharya is considered to be Vayuputra, which means he's the brother of Hanuman. Nice, isn't it? And also, who's his other brother? Anyone know? Bhimsen. Yes, Bhimsen is his other brother. So he was very strong. He could leap tall mountains with a single bound. And he used to wrestle tigers for sport. Pretty good. So when we talk about these great personalities, they're not just stereotypical Brahmins who just sit there chanting Om all day long. They preach, and some of them are quite strong even physically. Okay. So then, of course, just to culminate this whole discussion, then we have Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, who appeared in the 16th century AD, of course, who sort of is the culmination or taught the culmination of all the acharyas' teachings in something we call Achincha Beda Beda Tattva philosophy. That means that the Lord, Krishna, is one and different from everything simultaneously, inconceivably. That's Achincha. Achincha means inconceivable. So the example given in the Shastras or the scriptures is just like the sun is in one place, and there's a sun god in the sun, as hard as that may seem to believe, you know, even though the sun is millions of degrees hot, we cannot even get within, I would say, even closer than 5 million, anyway, you couldn't get it closer than 5 million miles to the sun without burning to death. But there's living entities with different types of bodies. And anyway, there's the chief of the sun, he's called Vivaswan, there's the sun globe, and then there's the sunshine. So the sunshine is all pervading. Like we say, when it's a sunny day, let the sun in. But you're not actually letting the sun in. So in one sense, the sun is everywhere. And in another sense, the sun is not everywhere. So in the same way, the Lord is everywhere with his energies. He's everywhere as the Paramatma expansion. But at the same time, Goloki Nivashati Akilatma Bhuta. He's in Goloka Vrindavan, enjoying life. How is that? That's inconceivable. Because we cannot be in more than one place at one time, right? Even when I try to multitask, I can't do it. I get in trouble. Sometimes I'm trying to give class and think of something else, and then, whoop, what was I saying? Doesn't work. But Krishna is the expert multitasker. He can do everything simultaneously, be aware of everything, what everyone is doing, what everyone's karma is, what his devotees are doing at the same time, be dancing with the gopis. Try that at home. Okay? So, that's really the background and of the philosophical Vedic background. Now we're going to talk about the Mahabharata, and I think most of you have access to this particular chart, the history. So, the Mahabharata, I don't know how far I'm going to get because I don't want to speak forever. I've already gone 16 minutes. So, the Mahabharata war, you can think, wow, it's really intense that so many people were killed, you know, millions and millions of people killed. So, and then you see so many people doing things that are inconceivable, like, I mean, this is interesting, like you have Grandfather Bhishma just sitting there while there's the attempted disrobing of Draupadi. I mean, I don't think any of us would sit there. And then you have Yudhisthira gambling his wife, what to speak of his brothers, what to speak of his kingdom. And so it's just like, huh? How would all these things happen? Well, the answer is, it's Krishna's plan. When Krishna plans something, he has this very interesting instrument called Maya. There's two types of Maya. There's the Yoga Maya, and then there's the Maha Maya. Now, Maya literally means energy. That's the literal definition. Although, for practical purposes, when we say that someone is in Maya, that means they're an illusion. For example, if I say to Adidev, or if he says to me, I'm this body, Maharaj. And if I say, I don't like your haircut, he said, I am offended. And I said, why? You're not the body. He said, well, I am the body. So that's Maya, right there, because he thinks he's the body, or he thinks he's from a particular country, or he thinks he's whatever. These are all nasato vijate bhavo nabhavo vijate sataha ubayor api drishna vantas twaniyas tatvadarshabhi. And I'll translate that. That the sages say that those things, if you think, I'm paraphrasing, if you think that those things are temporary or real, you are in Maya. And the sages say those things that continue to exist are real. I mean, this is real, yeah. Sure, this chair is real in one sense, but it's not an eternal truth. That's what we're talking about. It's not eternally that these atoms are going to compose this chair. I guarantee, you know, within 100 years, 200 years, the chair will be wood chips used in the garden or something like that, I'm sure. Just like we're chipping wood out in the garden there, so they'll put this chair through the chipper, maybe. So, there's not an eternal truth. So what are eternal truths? The eternal truth is I'm a spirit soul, part and parcel of Krishna. I'm 1/10,000 of the tip of the hair. It's very, very tiny. Can't see me with a microscope. So these are eternal truths. So this is really things that are true in a, let's say, eternal spiritual sense. And that's really what we're interested in. So anyway, so let's get back to the Maya stuff. So Maya, in this particular context, means illusion. So Krishna uses illusion for various purposes. In this world, the Mahamaya, which is another name for Mahamaya, is Durga, is used for the purpose of putting us in illusion. So we forget our real identity and try to enjoy, and then we end up not enjoying. We're like the junkie chasing after the carrot. That's Maya's business here. So you may say, wow, why does Krishna do such a thing? Well, the reason he does such a thing is because he wanted it. You know, if you want to play with fire, go play with fire. You're going to get burnt. Because we have free will. Without the ability to forget God, we would not be able to express our free will. Does everyone understand that? If God doesn't give you the ability to forget him, how can you say he gave you free will? You're just like, you know, I can't get God out of my mind. You'd be like the gopis, you know, who keep saying, stop talking about Krishna. No, stop it. I don't want to hear about that Krishna. You always chant Hare Krishna. And then the other gopi says, but you're saying, doing the same thing. So you wouldn't be able to forget Krishna. And it's necessary because you want to imitate him. If you want to imitate Krishna, you have to forget there is a real Krishna. So you become Ishwaroham Aham Bogi Siddoham Balavan Sukhi. That's from the chapter Divine and Demoniac Nature in Gita. So you're thinking, I'm the controller, I'm perfect, powerful, and happy. Wow, everyone has to listen to me. And then you run for president of the United States and offend everybody in the process. So that's an indirect reference. So therefore, Maya is necessary to allow us to express our free will and ultimately to allow us to understand our real position is with Krishna. So that's called Mahamaya, this Durga. And then in addition, there's this thing called Yogamaya, of which Mahamaya is an expansion. And so this Yogamaya is to help the devotees forget that Krishna is God, so they can interact with him in an intimate way. Right? Because it's not much fun just sitting with God on a pedestal all the time. And just, you know, can you imagine? We were talking to people today about going back to Godhead. All you get to do is sit and pray all day long. I don't think I want to go back to Godhead. It sounds pretty boring. There's no golf? No chess games? No TV? No newspapers? All you get to do is pray to the big guy. And he's just blessing you all the time. I bless you. Keep your prayers up. It's giving me a lot of happiness to hear your prayers. Well, I guess some people are into it like that. But really, we enjoy. How do we enjoy or why do we enjoy? Because we have personal relationships. You know, friends. I mean, you really have to have a friend to be happy in this world, right? A friend or someone you love, or at least a dog or a cat, if you can't find anyone to relate to, right? Or at least if you go to Japan, you can get a robot dog. They have them now. And they have robot ladies and robot men, you know, anatomically correct. So we need to interact. I mean, I think it was the poet Cowper who said, society, friendship, and love divinely bestowed upon man by God. Prabhupada quoted that verse. Society, friendship, and love, isn't it? I think it was the poet Cowper, wasn't it, who said it? But Prabhupada quoted that verse. So you need social, and that's where you have fun. You know, you can't just like sit there by yourself in your room all day unless you happen to be a nerd. And there's no nerds in the spiritual world. No computer nerds. So we need that. And in order to have fun in the spiritual world, you have to forget that you're playing with God. Because if you're playing with God and you're remembering he's God, you're going to be thinking, God forbid if I make a mistake. you know, here's God. You know, if I explain. Even if there was some really important person here, like Prabhupada. Let's say Prabhupada was here in the room. You're going to be very careful in dealing with him, you know, shaking. I remember being with Prabhupada. I practically shake each time I'd go in the room. I'd feel very, you know, I didn't become complacent at all. Prabhupada, would you like this? And Prabhupada interacted. But, you know, obviously I'm not going to have that sort of intimate relationship. So in the spiritual world, we need those intimate relationships. And in order to have those intimate relationships, then Krishna and his devotees have to forget about their ontological position. That means who they are. And so they can interact in a very loving, free-for-all way, like being the friend of Krishna, the parent of Krishna. Mother Yashoda, she's running behind Krishna with a stick. Would any of you run behind God with a stick to beat him? Any volunteers here? Run behind Lord Vishnu and Lakshmi? No. Woo. Don't want to do that. So Mother Yashoda, because she forgets that Krishna's God, until sometimes she looks in his mouth after he's eaten some dirt and she finds out he's eaten the whole universe and there's everything inside. And then she starts to think in awe and reverence, and Krishna says, I don't like this relationship. I want to have an intimate relationship. So Yogamaya was there to cover many of these personalities who did things. This is a good explanation. Who wouldn't ordinarily do those things or put up with those things. Try to understand this. This is Krishna's pastime we are dealing with. So Yoga Maya assists. She's a person. She assists Krishna's pastimes. And why did he want to do this? Okay, we already cleared that up. Why certain people did weird things that you'd never expect any other human being to do. So why did he do that? Because it was an interplanetary war. And I'll explain. Of course, it's only the 13th. On the 18th, you know, Star Wars is coming out. So this movie was based to a large extent on the archetypes presented in the Mahabharata and other Vedic literatures. I'm not advising you to go to see it. I'm just saying that. And one of my godbrothers wrote a book about this thing. So what happened is that there was a war, interplanetary war, between the good guys and the bad guys. The bad guys are called D-E-M-O-N-S. And the good guys are called D-E-V-A-S. What did I say? Any of your children know what I just said? What is D-E-M-O-N-S? Demons. And the good guys are called devas or demigods. So these things actually happen. There are good guys in the universe and bad guys, and the bad guys are trying to exploit everybody, and they're basically godless. And sometimes the bad guys become good guys, and sometimes the good guys become bad guys. Indra slips up from time to time, and he attacks or, let's say, does things with certain sages' wives. And the good guys, can anyone think of an example where a bad guy became a good guy? Starts with a B. Bali. He was on the wrong side of the force. Oh, sorry. He was on the wrong side. And by Lord Vamana's mercy, and of course by Prahlad Maharaj's mercy too, he became a devotee. So the bad guy became a good guy, and good guys become bad guys. And another good guy that became a bad guy is Krishna's own son. His name was Boma. Boma, everyone's heard of Boma? That means the earth son. And he became Bomasura. And Krishna had to kill him. So you have these things going on. So it's not really a clear-cut distinction that just because you were, well, I was born, my name is Veer Krishna Asura Swami, so therefore I'm a bad guy. You know, there's good guys born in every family and bad guys born in every family too. You know, that's life. Even Advaita Acharya, one of the great Acharyas, he had some sons who were good guys, some sons who were bad guys. So you judge by the qualities, not by the birth. Janma karma vibhagashaha. Guna karma vibhagashaha. Qualities and work. As Krishna says in the Gita. So, let's say, or go back to the Mahabharata, which I'm not going to have time to tell the whole story of, but at least we've given an introduction, is the bad guys had been defeated by the good guys. And this is mentioned in the eighth canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, where you have all these demons like Kalanayami and others who were killed by the demigods. And so they had an ability to take birth again, to choose where they were going to be bad guys. It's pretty good, isn't it? Because these aren't ordinary bad guys like in the Old West, some cowboy or something like that. They could choose where... So they generally they chose, like you have Kamsa, for example, who was Kalanayami before, and you have Jarasandha. Who was Jarasandha before? I forget right now. But he was... I forget it, who he was. But Jarasandha was one of the bad guys before who was killed in the war between the demigods and the demons. Okay, so they take birth on Earth. They think, wow, we've gotten away with it. We're coming down to the Earth planet. We're going to take over this Earth planet, get together our forces, and become more and more powerful. So, therefore, it was necessary for the good guys, headed up by Krishna, of course, to come down to the Earth planet to attack them and wipe them out. Because in the beginning of the 10th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, you have Bhumi, who is the personification of the Earth, going to who? Anyone remember the story? Who did she complain to?
Brahma.
Brahma. Because you have a right to complain in the universe. There's an ombuds system. And Lord Brahma is the ombudsman for the universe. So she went to Lord Brahma and said, wow, all these demons are here. I'm completely overburdened with these demons. Very similar situation to now. So anyway, demoniac political leaders. So anyway, not everyone, but I mean, very similar. So she went to Lord Brahma, but there's a different solution for now. We just chant Hare Krishna under Lord Chaitanya's instruction. We don't need a Mahabharat war. So, and then Lord Brahma says, well, basically he says, this is above my pay scale. In other words, I don't know if you understand that term. Those of you who use it, those who work in the business field. So then he went to his boss. And he went to his boss. His boss's name is Vishnu. Lord Vishnu, Shiradaksha Vishnu, lies on the shore of the ocean of milk. And he meditated and he had got a transmission. And transmission said, you should all go down to the Earth planet. I'm going to come down and we're going to take care of this. Don't worry. I'm in charge now. So when he heard that, then he instructed the demigods to take birth or to expand themselves as their parts and parcels. In other words, as children, empowered personalities who could help with this war. Incidentally, in the Mahabharata, and this is quite an interesting fact, Duryodhana was not actually counted amongst the demons who took birth. Duryodhana was Kali, the personality of the Kali Yuga, and his business was to make everybody angry with each other so they kill each other off. So he had a service for Krishna to perform. It's interesting. Even though we acted demoniacally, I'm not excusing any of his actions. So, therefore, Krishna wanted this war to take place so that these personalities who were harassing the earth and ultimately had plans and designs on the whole universe could be taken care of. And so their whole plan could be destroyed. And so therefore, let's talk about the Pandava's sons from this chart, and I'm not going to get a chance to read my whole summary of the Mahabharata or the events leading up to the war. So you have the Pandava's sons, for example, and Pandu, another thing is interesting is that the Kuru dynasty had become polluted by these demons. So it was necessary to end the Kuru dynasty. Absolutely necessary to end that dynasty. And therefore you find that descendants of the Kuru dynasty are not actually Kurus anymore. They're a combination of Yadus and demigods. Think about that for a second. Or Yadus. Yadus and demigods. Exactly. Because you have Arjuna, who was Indra's son. You have all the sons of the Pandavas, which you see on the chart here. You have, Arjuna, who was Indra's son. You have Yamaraj, who was Yudhisthira's son. Bhimsen, who was Vayu's son. Nakula, who was from the Ashwini Kumaras. And Sahadeva, who was also from the Ashwini Kumaras. So they're all basically, they're all offsprings of the demigods and of Kunti, who is from the Yadu dynasty. So no more Pandu, no more Kuru dynasty after this point. Right? Everyone understands the logic? Because that dynasty had become polluted. And of course, therefore, you have Bhima having some children. Bhima had two children. Arjuna had quite a few more, as you see from the chart. Bhima had Ghatotkach and Sutta Soma from Draupadi and Ghatotkach from Hidimbi. Right? Everybody can see on this chart. It's a very interesting chart. And then Yudhisthira, of course, had Prativinja. And all these personalities were killed in the battle. Ghatotkach, of course, was killed saving Arjuna from the dart of Indra. So he sacrificed his life. And then Nakula and Draupadi had Satanika, and Sahadeva and Draupadi had Shutasena. But Arjuna was actually the most prolific. It's not that, like some people say, he went to Argentina and founded Argentina. It's not true. But Arjuna, you see here, he had Shutakarma from Draupadi, Iravat from Ulupi, and they all fought in the Battle of Kurukshetra. From Chitrangada he had Bhruvahan, and from Subhadra he had the actual person who carried out the dynasty, which is Abhimanyu. And Abhimanyu got married to Uttara, then there was Parikshit, and Janamajaya was produced. So you see that all the demons, and actually, as Krishna says in the Gita, you know, everybody besides yourself, the Pandavas, and of course there was a few others, were wiped out in the battlefield of Kurukshetra. So that's the back. That's the background. I don't have time to tell the whole story. However, why was the Bhagavad Gita spoken? Here's another point. The Bhagavad Gita was spoken to encourage Arjuna to carry out his duty in spite of not wanting to carry out his duty because of particular attachments he had. Now, those attachments are not necessarily bad. Generally, one should not be killing their gurus or their cousin brothers. I mean, obviously, that should not be there. But it was necessary for Arjuna to hear the Bhagavad Gita, not because he was a coward, but for two reasons. There's the exoteric reason. The exoteric reason is because he actually didn't want to do something that he considered to be irreligious. And he gives many arguments in the first part of the Bhagavad Gita, such as destroying the dynasties and other things like that. And the esoteric reason is so that we could hear the Bhagavad Gita. In many cases, you have devotees who act the part as if they don't know anything or an illusion so that Krishna can speak. And even one time, Krishna acted as a student and had his devotee teach him. That's very interesting. In the Chaitanya Charitamrita, you have Lord Chaitanya who acted as the student of Ramananda Roy, who is an incarnation of Vishakha. And Lord Chaitanya was asking, what's the goal of human life? What's the process to receive the goal? And Lord Chaitanya kept saying, I don't accept this particular answer, and just pushed him higher and higher and higher. Also, you have Parikshit Maharaj and Shukadev Goswami. Parikshit Maharaj also knew the philosophy, obviously. He was a pure devotee. But he asked these questions for our benefit, and also the sages, headed up by Shonaka Rishi, who asked Sutta Goswami these questions for our benefit. So you'll find that Arjuna is actually asking the questions for our benefit, and Krishna is answering the questions, and the whole Bhagavad Gita was spoken in at about 35-40 minutes. It's a pretty good Bhagavad Gita class. Actually, I've spoken longer than that right now, and I haven't even gotten to the Bhagavad Gita. So these are the events. I mean, I had a whole preparation of just the whole story, but we don't have time to tell it. But this is the general philosophical explanation of why the Mahabharata war was fought, the purpose of it, how the people put up with things they wouldn't ordinarily put up with, and what Krishna's plan is, and how sometimes, another point is, how sometimes the devotees are put into difficulty for their own benefit and the benefit of humankind. Like the Pandavas were certainly put into a lot of difficulty, right? The poisoning, attempted poisoning of Bhimsen, the house of lack. I mean, you go one thing after the other. Yeah, being put into exile for so many years. I mean, or even when Arjuna voluntarily accepted exile, when he had to intrude upon Draupadi and Yudhisthira to get the weapons. I think everybody knows that story. And Arjuna had to go in exile, but there was a purpose for it. And the purpose was so that he could have some of the children I mentioned, get married to Subhadra, and later on get some weapons. So everything has a purpose that the Lord does. Although we may not understand it at that particular juncture. And Queen Kunti, interestingly enough, she prayed for more difficulties. We should not do that. She prayed for more difficulties so that she would always remember Krishna. Tatra Tatra Jagat Guru. Why? Apunar Bhavadarshanam. That's from the Bhagavatam. So that I won't see repeated birth and death in this world. So Krishna, the point I'm making is Krishna accomplishes so many things with every action. And even though it's inconceivable, unbelievable what Krishna does, he has a plan. And he has a plan. Here's some interesting thing. He has a plan for each one of us. That's a non-denominational statement. God has a plan for you. And we just have to fasten our seatbelts and get ready to go back to Godhead. So any questions or comments about any of these points? Yes. Yeah.
And he went through many difficulties in his life and obtained
yes.
the mantra. Can you speak a little bit about why we use here the Maha mantra, but none of the others that are from kind of the larger tradition?
That's actually a good point. Actually, we do use some of the other mantras. Om Namo Narayanaya, I mean, I use that many times. I've been in Sri Rangam in South India many times, and I love to chant that mantra. But Ramanujacharya, let's go back to when he received that mantra, which is interesting. He was told, this shows his great compassion, because you gave me the opportunity to glorify Sripad Ramanujacharya. When he was given that mantra by Goshtipurna, his mantra guru, he was told not to repeat it to anyone because it had the ability to liberate anyone. And it certainly does. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu states, Nam Namakari Bahoda Nija Sarva Shaktis, that any of the names of God are imbued with all the potency of God, right? I think you all know that. That's the second verse in the Shishashtaka. So he got that mantra, and the guru said, anyone who hears this will get liberated. It's a secret mantra. And actually, I was listening to a class that Prabhupada gave, or a discussion Prabhupada gave, about one guru who was charging for his mantra. He would charge. First, he started $35, then he upped the price when he saw he had a good market to $125. So Prabhupada said, if the mantra is actually bona fide, you don't charge for it. So Ramanujacharya heard this mantra from his guru, said, yes, Gurudev, I accept your instructions, but then he went out and broadcast it to everybody. He's got on the top of the tallest building in the town, which probably was not a skyscraper in those days. And he said, everybody chant, Om Namo Narayanaya, Om Namo Narayanaya. And then everyone began to chant, we'll get liberated, and they were all jumping up and down. Next to see, the guru came out and said, you've offended me, you're going to hell. And Ramanujacharya said, you know, with respect. He didn't say, that's all right, Gurudev. He said with respect, I apologize, but I know this mantra, liberates everyone, Gurudev. I know I'm going to suffer because of offenses at your lotus feet. But I'm willing to do that, to liberate everyone. And the guru, Goshtipurna, said to Ramanujacharya, you are my guru, basically. You're greater than me. So there's that mantra, and in South India, of course, if you go into Sri Rangam, the mantra is playing on the loudspeakers everywhere. You know, Om Namo Narayanaya, Om Namo Narayanaya. So we do chant a lot of other mantras too. So also we chant Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya, mantras like that. The reason, okay, now I'm going to explain the reason why the Hare Krishna mantra is considered the Mahamantra. In the Ikali Santara Upanishad, it mentions the Mahamantra is the the Hare Krishna mantra is the Mahamantra. I mean, there's many Vedic conjunctions like that. And there's different manifestations of God. They're all the same person. According to Brahma Sangita, Advaita Chuda Nadir Anantarupam, there's one God, but he has unlimited forms. So, of all those forms, the Bhagavatam describes that Eti Changsa Kalak Pumsa, Krishna's two Bhagavan Swayam. So Krishna's, let's say, the origin, and the Brahma Samhita talks about one candle from whom many other candles are lit. There's many examples given like that in the Vedic, particularly the Puranas. So when you chant Krishna's name, then that is the most, I would say, most potent, direct, intimate. Let's use the word intimate. All the names of God are actually the same person. It's the most intimate name of God. And there is some description, like a thousand names of Vishnu are equivalent to one name of Ram, and was it three names of Ram? Was it? Three names of Ram are equivalent to one name of Krishna. So they all have the same potency, but it's the intimacy is there. So it really depends on your relationship. It's not that one is necessarily better than the other. That what is your relationship with God? And in fact, you can talk about that with anybody. You know, what is my relationship with Adi Dev? You know, his wife will call him honey. I don't call him honey. Right? So there's different relationships and different names with the same person. You know, I don't have the most intimate relationship with him anyway. I call him, hey you, or something. So,